Yeah, I was working, left Ireland, and I was working in Vancouver on my way to Japan with my new wife. And we wanted to go to a Zen monastery in Japan, 1969. And anyway, when I got to Vancouver, I realized I didn't want to go any further. So it was far enough. Went down to the harbor in Vancouver and tried to get on the freighter and talking to the captain and another couple that we knew were from New York, Jewish couple that we befriended. And so anyway, they decided to go and we decided to stay. And I actually didn't like Vancouver, and I was on Vancouver Island and I met this guy just by accident, and he was a great character. He was from New York originally, but he was living in Toronto and teaching at York University, and we hit it off, and he said, if you ever come back east, come and see me. So I kind of had it with social work that time, and my wife and I drove down through the States, went right around the States, visiting her family. She's from the United States. Visited her family in LA and Texas, Florida. Then we came up in February and landed in Toronto, and this guy's name is Jack, and went to visit him, and once more hit it off, and he asked us if we'd like to move in with him and his girlfriend and his friend and his girlfriend. So six of us moved in to this part of Toronto, north of Toronto, the Pickering area that was fighting the proposed Pickering Airport. And I think that's how I got to PEI. Although, a year prior to that, after traveling all around Canada and North America, decided I just didn't like Central or Western Canada or the United States. And I wanted to go back and live in Scotland. I was originally from Ireland. So thank you, dear. And anyway, to make a long story short, met Jack, lived there, got involved in the anti-airport movement, a lot of local organizations, local people, and just realized how important land was to people and what a destruction it would have been to see those beautiful farms leveled and the whole thing turned into a gigantic, unnecessary airport. And in fact, Ryan, I still dream of the most beautiful place in the world, and my dream that I'd like to go, and my dreams, I've narrowed them down to southern Ontario, just the farmland and the trees. It's really gorgeous, and it's very rich land. What I learned then was, like, I had a terrible time connecting with the land in North America. And I grew up in Ireland, very, like, in a small town like Charlottetown, but the land was, feeling of the land was really strong, and for me, and I couldn't connect with the land in North America until after about 2 years here, I realized that nobody named the land, and in Ireland everybody names everywhere. It's similar to PEI to some extent, but more pronounced because it's been settled for longer, but only the natives named the land in Canada, and I felt really, I remember being a number of times feeling very disoriented. I was an immigrant too, but feeling very distanced and disoriented from the land. To make a long story short, the movement against the airport not only radicalized me to some extent, but it also, it did, because it showed me how big government and corporational kind of thinking could just run over people. And these people were standing up and they were very strong and they want it. Well, we want it. They stopped the airport, and a number of the people who were in pollution probe and were active in the environmental movement were involved in that and cut their teeth on it. And they were like people basically people from elite backgrounds in Ontario, rich kids, you know. I didn't know that at the time, but anyway, just to divert a bit, the land had been meant much of the, a lot of the farm, some of the farmland anyway, had been expropriated, and that's why we were living there. And a real estate company in Los Angeles was running, but the land, a lot of land had been expropriated, and the farms were empty that had sold out, and a real estate company was renting them out. And I don't know who controlled or got that real estate company, but it was called Century City.
Okay.
And we thought, you know, here we were, we rented a big farmhouse that someone had left and sold out, and some company from LA was renting it to us, and some guy going around in a suit, you know, hired by them. And the whole thing smelled bad, you know. So anyway, the connection there is that the reason why there was a community outside Toronto at all, back to the land, nearly back to the land movement community, was because those houses had been emptied and they had been expropriated.
Mm-hmm.
They were either expropriated or willingly sold, you know. So the people that moved into those houses, and there were quite a few of them in those concession roads, we all felt like a community. And we're all long-haired, you know, long-haired people, you know, and girls, you know, hippie girls and guys, and we're all, and then they moved, into, because we had cheap accommodation, we got into that movement, and we were very active, and that was the first taste of land. We were living on farmland by accident. So I got to know those people over 18 months, and at a certain point we decided we wanted to get serious about getting land. And there were probably about the two streams that I recall from there, from that area, and one moved to Lake Ainslie area in Cape Breton. And a bunch of them moved over there, and another bunch of us, the people that I lived with, and two other households, decided to move to PEI. I thought about moving to the Maritimes, rather, right? But what really triggered it for me was that a neighbor who was a draft dodger from North Carolina, and his wife, and their couple, and then their couple friends, who both the men had evaded the draft. When I got to know him, he lived nearby. He was building a geodesic dome in the YMCA workshop down in Toronto, and he had been in PEI the year before, and said it was an incredible place. And he came back and immediately started building a geodesic dome to put on the train and send to Carrigan and PEI. So I started helping him do that, among other people.
And to PEI?
Yeah. Yeah, the trains were still running.
Yeah.
So in November, and I think it was 1971, I would go down in the winter, in the late summer and winter, and we cut out the 5.2-foot struts for the triangles of the geodesic dome. I remember cutting them on the YMCA saws, cutting the PCV pipe so that we could bolt the ends together. Well, I didn't even know what the plan. I knew what geodesic dome was, but he's a very brilliant guy, economist guy, left the United States. So in October, we loaded a boxcar in the rail yard in Toronto, and we sent it off to the Cardigan, and it arrived in February. It took 4 months to get the Cardigan. It was just a single little box car. It only shunted from there to here, you know, through every backyard, rail yard. And then he went out with his wife, sat in Cardigan rail yard, and he went out in May, and he started putting it up. And I went out and spent a period of time with him nailing and putting it up.
And down from
Toronto to see it. And just to help not kind of move here or anything, because I'd heard from where I was working that PEI had a very severe winter, and I wasn't sure I could take it. Wasn't sure I could take it even then. I'm not sure I could take it even now, 30 years later. But anyway, So there it was. All their possessions went down here in a boxcar, and we started putting it up, put down a circular foundation, and got this incredible building with triangles with sheets of plywood cut out that went on them. And then I can't remember how he finished. He had a plan to finish the scenes with some kind of adhesive or glue. Anyway, I went back to, it was such a wonderful experience, went back to Toronto, and I said, to my wife, gotta get back to PEI. So we saved up for a year, and the other two couples and us and two other people, we went off in three cars in a convoy, and we headed for the Maritimes. We first went to Cape Breton, and we visited the other bunch that moved from those concession roads, which was Uxbridge and Stouffville. That's where we were. And not the Toronto.
Okay.
It was Stouffville and Uxbridge, and that was the edge of the proposed airport. So we visited a bunch at Lake Ainslie. There was a whole bunch of them from that region, and from all, you know, Toronto people. There's a huge number of people. There's like 20 or 30 people that were living in Lake Ainslie area.
Mm.
Yeah. And the guy that I came here with to build the geodesic dome, the couple that he lived, that they lived with in Ontario, moved there to Lake Ainslie. So anyway, we visited there, and we really loved it, you know, all around the Cabot Trail, but it looked like it was really quite isolated, too. And I'm not sure if that community has survived, you have to know. So I loved it, you know, loved Cape Breton. It was incredibly wild, and, you know, the fields. But I'd seen PEI the year before, and so we came to PEI, and we went to, we went up to the guy with the dome, and we stayed there, and I think I stayed there for 6 months, helping him, you know, and built a little shack for my wife and myself, and the other people found accommodation. It sort of was like a bridgehead in the East Coast. And there was a whole bunch up there in Cardigan that were in that area that did not move with us. You know, like we were about 8 or 10 or 11
mm-hmm.
people. What was interesting was that the stream of people that came out of into St. George's, I don't know how they got there, but I know how some of them got there, and it was the Kent State student demonstration
mm-hmm.
where the National Guard shot four students dead. You heard about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there was at least four of the people, and maybe all of them, they had been at Kent State, but they were at Kent State and some of them witnessed that. And they just said, that's it, we're getting out of here. So, like, I was on the way down today, and I wanted to say that like, I had, like, personal reasons, probably, or preconditions that made me more likely to join that kind of movement, right? And actually, what they were was, although I lived in Ireland, which is an entirely different context, you know, I was very interested in what was called in the late 50s the Beat Movement.
Mm.
Heard of it?
Yeah.
Okay, they were the precursors of like a modern nonconformist movement or whatever. You know, and all the poets that went with that, Ginsberg and Ferlinghetti. We were reading all those at university in Ireland, Jack Kerouac, you know, and the European existentialist Sartre and Camus and all those guys. Like we were reading all those in university in Ireland. And I think it predisposed me, that and the music, I was into the blues a lot.
Okay.
But when I came to North America, I just felt like I was congruent with what people were doing in North America. And I found that interesting that piece of culture that became a global kind of culture thing. How did it begin with Ireland? Because Ireland was a backwater, you know, it was like Quebec. But it did, because there was something to do, there was something that needed to be protested in some way. And I'm just trying to tell you that I think the protesting movement of the 1960s that was a result of the nuclear threat, that's my theory, but it's not my theory, but it's a reasonable theory that all of that repression that was happening, spiritual repression was happening as a result of the Cold War, had to be broken, and I think all of this movement was breaking now. And if there's anything you can give kudos to that movement for, it's that. And my children, you know, I tried to tell them that too, because they think everything was incredibly rosy and glorious at the time. But we were freaking terrified in Ireland of the nuclear threat, you know. And you know, I think that there was a whole rejection of how our parents accepted that. Oh, that's the way things are. You know, you hear that from the generation before often, you know. Oh, that's the way it is, you know. Oh, don't worry about it, you know. The Russians won't do it because they're going to get bombed too, you know. It's like two guys coming together in the car. They're not going to hit each other. But what they're forgetting is for children and for younger people, the feeling of terror of that, you know. So anyway, I think that was like a climate that maybe spawned this particular thing.
Did you end up in the area you live in now?
No. I was in Cardigan, and I simply, quite simply, heard that there was a piece of land available in near Wood Islands. You know, was the next the winter after I moved there, and I went down with a guy from St. George's. He still lives in Lower Montague. His name is Peter Lux. Really good guy, and he came from the States, and he might know, because he was in St. George's. He would know how those people got there, but the Kent State Bunch came here because of that shooting. And when they came here and had that commune, they were a real wild bunch in there. And there were some people from Ontario with them too. But I think I was telling you on the phone that I think it was 1971, they were all in there happily raising their horses and pigs and goats. And an eyewitness account from a guy from Kitchener who was staying in there. Jim said that at 6 in the morning, they were getting up to feed the animals, and a helicopter hovered over the commune, right? And they're blaring down, like, you know, "Everybody on the ground," you know, and they had all these sirens going, and out of the woods came all these guys with flak jackets and machine guns, and I don't know many of them. I heard there was 50 of them, and he said, "We were all lying on the ground with guns on our heads," and he said, Jim's a very abrasive guy, you know what I mean? He looked at me and said, "What the fuck are you doing?" I said, you know, I'm from Canada and I live here in Kitchener. I don't know what Jesus you're doing. They wouldn't tell them, you know. Eventually, after questioning them, they kind of put their guns away and were chit-chatting and everything and being nice and trying to be nice. And they took off, helicopter and the whole thing. And you know what it was? There was a bunch of terrorists in the United States called the Minutemen, and they were bombing public water supplies, and one of the women in Cardigan with long blonde hair was in the Stewart and Beck store in Montague, and somebody saw her, some American tourist saw her
and said she was one of the Minutemen.
It was the famous one, Kathy somebody. I heard about her lately on radio. Who, you know, they did blow up places in the States. So the RCMP and I think the Army and the immigration, that's who went in. It was an incredible story. And if you look through the archives of the Eastern Graphic, Jim McNeil has editorialized, and he's dead now, but he's editorialized, and he covered that story and editorialized on it about every 3 years. Because he was anti, you know, stupid government. And this was a perfect case. So anyway, those guys were Americans, and that's why they were attacked that way. But my, I was looking for a piece of land, and Peter and I and my wife went down to the Lewis area where I live now, and there was a piece of land an old farmer had for sale, and bought that, and built a house on it, and raised two children there, and the neighbors that had their, two of them, the woman with the blonde hair, who was supposed to be the Minute Woman, she and her husband bought down the road from me. And then a guy called Mike Paget, who's a friend of mine and a musician, he just turned up down the road, like from Vancouver. And another friend of his in Bell River. And then there was a guy called Kip Smith and his wife at the time, Nancy, who came up from Boston. I don't know how they got there. A fellow called Doug Deacon from Ontario, who owns the trail site. He moved down with his wife and then had four kids. Donald Deacon was his father, who was a local entrepreneur, businessman. He moved down here when he retired. But an interesting point is that Mike Paget lived in Belcarra Park in eastern Vancouver. It was a park, and they were squatting there in some cottages, him and a guy called Northcott, who moved up to Mount Stewart, and a fellow called Peter Crosscoff, who's a teacher at Colonel Gray. Mike and that bunch were living in Vancouver, and there was a periodical that came around called Bingham's Land Properties, and it was just you could get it. It had like tax sale properties in Canada, anywhere. And Mike said they put a pin in it, and there was one on the Selkirk Road in PEI. And that's how he got here with his wife from California. He's from Montreal. So, like, I don't know, like, I can color, like, paint a climate, you know, but at the same time, another bunch moved from, just finished that thought, it was, what's that, serendipity, that the people got together, like, that came to these places. There was a bunch of people from UNB in Fredericton. Two brothers from Winnipeg who went out to study there, and two brothers from Montreal, and people, you know, from Fredericton who were at university. And they moved down to Iris as a group of people and bought land and did the same thing as we were doing. And there's no connection. And there's no connection with St. George's bunch. There's no connection with the Irish bunch. There was no connection with the bunch where I am in the Lewis area. I'm in the Garlock. Garlock. G A I R L O C H. No Gaelic name. I got it on the map, by the way.
Yeah,
it's not on the map. I asked the community if we could return the name to the old name from the 1880s Meacham's Atlas. It was called Garlock. And after a bit of time, the government agreed, so it's on the map.
Anyway, there's a bunch, there was a few in Montague, people that, like when I say this, it almost sounds like we're another race, but you could go into Montague and recognize people by the long hair and weird toes at that time, but they weren't from here. You knew each other right away. Where are you from? Oh, I'm from Indianapolis. What are you doing here? Oh, I'm just living up in the shack up in the Seal River Road, you know? Like, I don't understand that serendipity, but I think the climate was protest, and it was environmental, very environmentally driven. Like, we were reading all the Whole Earth catalogs and all those books, and wanted to build windmills and greenhouses. Like, I'm a gardener and greenhouse type thing. That was what I got into.
How did people get into the Whole Earth?
The Whole Earth catalog. It was an early form of. There was no internet, right?
Yeah.
But there was a lot of magazines and. Alternate newspapers.
Yeah.
I think radio and the media, television, radio were not mediums that moved information like that around. But there was a whole underground. It's a term I haven't used for 30 years. But the term underground was used. There's a whole underground subversion thing going on politically in North America. There was a very violent protest against the Vietnam War, which I was involved in England and here. I lived in England, and it was like it was in Europe too, you know. And out of that came a really obstinate and stubborn movement, political movement. And the back of the land was kind of the gentle side of it, you know. Well, it was all idealistic, but it was more like. When my friend Jack and I came down here from Ontario, we were sure in 1970, 1971 that the whole society was going to collapse. We were quite certain it was going to collapse, and that's something that seems ridiculous, but at this point, but we were sure that the energy crisis was well underway. The awareness that the type of energy we used was not sustainable. We were quite aware of that. And we were sure that, I think part of the reason, like, I wanted to live in a place where there's a sense of community, because you lived in Ontario or in any of those cities, and there was no sense of anything. The worst of the suburban life, people separated into, you know, that was the future that was painted for us with university degrees. That's where we were going, and we didn't want any of that. Those of us who, we just wanted to change the whole freaking thing. But to answer that, there was an underground feeling, and the information. So, like, the Whole Earth catalog and was, everybody had one.
Okay.
It was just like, it was had a kind of an internet.
Okay.
It was like a source. And you read through that freaking thing, and they told you everything in there, how to change your whole life and how to change other people's lives. And it was very practical, yeah. And I think I liked that, you know, and it wasn't. And when we came to the island, the old people here, I told you that on the phone, they knew what we were doing. They could remember. It was the middle generation that were going, what the fuck are these guys doing? You know, we're just getting running water and indoor plumbing. And they don't have it. I had no running water for 6 years, and I loved it. Outdoor toilet, no running water, no lights. We had kerosene lamps, outhouse, and an old pump. And no sound in the house. The day that we finally, when we got two kids, and we said, Jesus, we have to wash diapers and everything. And we were washing diapers, we weren't buying diapers. And I bought a fridge.
and I couldn't believe how invasive the sound was. The whole fucking house was vibrating. And it was a new fridge, It was just like a... It's very disturbing. And when the lights came on, I just felt invaded, you know? But when we had been to a running water, I almost went on my knees and thanked God for it. 6 years of pumping water in the winter. But the old people, if we came around, they'd come around, they'd say, yeah, it's the way we used to live. We got power, but hey, yeah, there's a lot to be said for this. And it's good what you're doing, you know, yeah. Oh, you're keeping the pigs. Yeah, we have the pigs. So, you know, we had a natural... A lot of those people adopted. The stories you hear, almost everyone who lived here was adopted by somebody, some person in the community, and have developed and kept that close relationship with, you know, someone who saw... Probably saw that, you know, that we were probably supporting, you know, a sustainable... the way the island had been sustainable. We were supporting that.
Were you adopted by a particular family?
Yeah. And you know, you could always go up to the house and you were welcoming, and there's some people that give you dirty looks here, you know, and or you go into a pub, you know, and we used to get into the odd fight here because of long hair and because, you know, we were against the United States. That was surprising to find how strong the feeling pro the United States was in PEI. And it's a lot to do with the immigration. And you talk about the United States. Now, I don't talk like that here. You know, trying to get rid of President Nixon at the time, you know, he's just an asshole. What did you call him? You know? Anyway. Geez, a long time ago we're talking about, Ryan.
The first set of property that you bought, is that where you live now?
Yeah, still there.
Okay, so the first place you bought was on the Garlock Road.
On the Garlock Road.
How much did you buy?
About 40 acres, 30 acres of woods, and more than that, I guess. It was about 5-8 acres of cleared land.
Okay. And so being back to Wyoming, so what was your mindset about that?
At that time.
So like, you're talking about living off the grid early on?
Yeah.
And until you had kids?
Yeah, we did have kids for a period of time off the grid, but it was really hard. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what changed that.
Were you using the wood for heating?
Yeah. Yeah, and the kerosene lights, put in a pump, it cost a lot of money to put in a pump. It was high ground, it's very high ground out there. The neighbor's well was 120 feet, and we were less than that, but it cost a lot of money.
Gardening.
No, we didn't keep animals, we kept chickens for the manure, but... No, a lot of people got into horses and goats and pigs and didn't necessarily look after them all that well. Yeah. I just didn't feel like I could do that. Well, you know, I saw a lot of people not knowing what to do.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure you've heard that, and I just didn't want to do that. Chickens were perfectly, you know, reasonable and supplied manure. So we were big gardeners. We had a greenhouse attached to our house. Still there, and grow vegetables in it every year. I tried, I turned the land over and, rented farm equipment to do it, you know, from neighbors, but I wasn't a farmer. I wasn't looking for that. I was looking for extensive gardening, big gardening, and we put up a lot of food, you know, an awful lot of food in bottles and dried it.
How big was your garden?
Well, probably the size of a gym, you know, like a school gym, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, all by hand. It's been shrinking.
still big. I still had a big garden. It was twice the size of this restaurant.
Is that all by hand? Is that all the learning by trial and error?
Yeah, my wife was quite a good gardener, you know, and
she's from Ontario?
No, she was from Maryland.
Okay.
She's from Michigan, American.
Okay.
In fact, her grandfather, who was from Florida, saw the way we were living. He was an old man at that time in the 70s. She was probably 90. And I remember him saying, if I was your age, I'd be living like this now. And he'd been a watchmaker and lived in St. Louis. And it was also the climate of the time, you know. I mean, you know, we didn't want to be dependent on corporations and corporate food. So, that was part of it, too.
Did you get into the windmills or solar energy or anything like that?
No. Just,
what,
no.
Technology?
Yeah, I wasn't technological. Well, many did. You know, a neighbor down the road got into windmill and but his battery pack was gigantic. You know, he had this huge battery system.
Yeah.
And it didn't, you know, it didn't really yield too much.
Did you build your own house?
Yeah, I built the house.
How did you learn that?
Well, I started with a chainsaw.
Did you build a house before?
No. Everyone, you know, people come around and when I was building it, local people would turn up and give you advice. And I built it all with chainsaw, handsaw. And it was quite good, you know, bought all the lumber, you know, some lumber came from my woods and some I bought from a local sawmill. You read a lot about it, you know, it was part of that whole earth thing, you know. Many people on the island, I'd say most of them built their own places, you know.
Well, the journey usually comes up as the idea of self-sufficiency.
Yeah.
And that's the key fundamental of that whole
value.
Where does that come from? Is that just the idea that the energy crisis is coming and that, you know, things are so bad where we've been or where some of us we've seen? Is that why people want to be self-sufficient so bad? Or is it just you also mentioned about wanting to be beholden to the corporations?
I don't really know the answer to that. I'm not really sure.
No,
Fall is Beautiful is there.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, is that the kind of thing you're really into as well?
It's a hard question to answer. I mean, the propaganda of that movement was all about self-sufficiency. Mm-hmm. And then the whole Earth Catalog, all that stuff was about self-sufficiency. And like all those people I mentioned, you know, the guy with the geodesic dome or the people in Cape Breton, you know, that was what was driving them, was how can we get out of this system and prove that we don't have to have a centralized system, because a centralized system leads to more control and more social control and more policies like the Vietnam War and the bombs, you know, all that stuff. So I think it goes back to that. I'm just a very simple-minded theorizing, but I think in my own nature, though, like I came from Ireland and my family were very self-sufficient in terms of gardening, so I think I continued. So, I mean, I wonder if that was a thread for some people, too. But, I mean, Ryan, it's like, it's really exciting to grow your own food. I find it really exciting. Still do. I grow a lot of my own food, and a lot of Islanders do. I know a lot of Islanders who put up food, and you know, people that would never involved with the kind of movement I was involved with, but maybe just grew out of the self-sufficiency of the island farming culture, you know, to grow a lot of their own food. So, like, I think we were coming here to find people who still knew how to do that.
And that's why we came to these rural places, because we knew that people were doing that, you know, were still living that way. And they were. Some people were, you know, in their own way. Maybe not, you know, we came here just at the time when the small farms were disappearing. I know the man told me that, the local man told me that people from Charlottetown to Wood Islands in 1967-68, even then, every farm was an operating farm, a small mixed farm. And that died very, very quickly. It might have died throughout the 60s. They claim, some people have searched that claim, that, and because it happened in Ireland too at the same time, the plowshares and the farm equipment were made prior to 1960, they were built by blacksmiths. And around about the late 1950s, early 1960s, they were made by factories with alloys that the farm, the blacksmiths couldn't weld, couldn't fix. And the theory is that, because the blacksmiths all died out all at once, is that there was a change of culture, of agriculture, at that point. And along with the developing plan on the island, where they wanted big is better, and the migrations and immigrations out of here, within 10 years, all of those farms were gone. You still see the odd small farm with the barns around them, not necessarily operating anymore. And then the milk quotas, the only way to make a living. Everybody, prior to when we came here, prior to the Liberals brought in the milk quota system, rural farms, they all had the mixed farming, like they put some milk out there in the cans, you know?
Yeah.
So they always had a check. They had the egg check, they had the cash crop check, they had five or six sources of money. But with the development plan and the collapse of the rural technology, they farms consolidated, and the only ones who could survive were the ones who were big beef farms or milk or had a milk quota.
Yeah, sure. You mentioned that you lived relatively close to Angus McLean.
Yeah.
Did you have any interaction with
him? Oh, yeah, lots. Yeah.
What was that like?
Great.
Yeah.
He was a real, really forward-thinking guy for a guy who always said he was a backward guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he fought against the Point of Crow. We were aware at that time when we were fighting against the Crow. And he gave us information. I can't remember the year, but I think Angus might have been in at the time. But he did take a public stand against the doctors here, and tried to raise fees, and he took a public stand against the fraud. And he fed us information, and we put out a newspaper against the fraud. And I was on the edge of that. I wasn't very deeply involved in it, but I helped with the newspaper. And Angus gave us information, but Angus was just a true Tory. I think I might have told you that one actually. A true Tory,
British style
Tory. He really believed in the community. And the negative downsides of it is that the Tories tended to have a system where there were big landowners and servants. They had the serfs, the old system. So there was an elite and a working class that were kept down. That was the downside of it. But the upside of it was that they always looked after those people. Like there was a kind of a rural largesse. They never let them starve.
Yeah.
So he came out of that tradition. But where he came into the modern world was he was trying to fight for the sense of the rural culture here. And he really did. He did. Just a very nice, simple man. You know, very gentle
did
character.
Did he have any kind of interaction with Axel Andrews?
Did he?
Was he like accepting?
Well, he came to all our events, him and his wife. You know, we'd come if we had a funeral or a wedding or something. We'd always ask Angus and his wife, and they'd just turn up, and we'd be in the weirdest outfits. And they didn't care.
And then he brought his children back here too, and they became friends of ours. They were teenagers, late teenagers from Ottawa.
Okay.
And they went to like school at Montague, and they were younger than us, but they became part of our community. Still are. I don't want to be too boastful in any way, because I really don't. No, I know, because I don't know how much the people that moved here affected the island, because the island was changing anyway, you know. But I think the peace movement at Goyside was very important. The Andy LePro movement was important, and I think Angus was glad to have people here, you know, and he kind of fed us stuff, you know. He told us what was going on the inside, and how he said, you know, follow this up, you know.
That's when he's premier.
Yeah, yeah. So he just to his neighbors. Yeah. Yeah.
Back
yeah.
Him up.
Yeah, no, it is nice, you know.
That's
yeah, it was surprised me, you know, and because he was just my neighbor, and I didn't think of him as a politician when I met him as a neighbor. He's just a great guy, you know. And so I didn't talk politics with him, but I remember when we did talk politics with him about the kind of politics we were interested in, he knew stuff, and he would just pass the information, talk to him, or go to him, or that information's available there, you know. I don't know if I can make any big statement, you know, about that. Like, I do think that people... the people who moved here and stayed here have contributed a lot, but I'm not going to say they've contributed anything more than anybody else here in the island, you know. Like, they might have, they started certain kind of businesses, you know, or they worked in service industries that, you know, that help people, or they, you know, they brought music here. But like, I really think it's a fabric thing. It's not like, oh, they stand out.
Okay.
I think the people that we're talking about here, they became parts of many communities, and that's what's cool about, like, it's anything, is that they're, like, when Mike Paget and myself talk about it, like, he and I are involved in so many different communities of people. Like, a community is not just where you live. You know, like, there's the music community, or the... My wife's involved in the farmer's market community, you know, or... Mike's involved in the Echo Pie, the ecological movement here, or, you know, I'm involved, I teach Tai Chi, you know, I've taught Tai Chi for 21 years to people in wheelchairs as a volunteer, and that's a community, right?
Yeah.
To all those people with MS that I meet, and I teach them, and I've been teaching them every week for 20 years.
What country were you into before you came here?
Well, yeah, I lived in Ontario.
Okay.
Another one, yeah.
Yeah, why, and this is another, you may not have an answer, but why are some people able to stay on PEI and some people who are bachelorlanders just got up and left?
I lament for those who have left. I lament for, sometimes I feel I'll be the last one here, because I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah, sure. All right.
They're getting me out of here, but, breakups in relationships, lack of opportunity. You know, a lot of people did change and wanted to make money. You know, wanted to have a better lifestyle. Some people, because they were drawn back to where they were from, because of family reasons. You know, people, career changes. People, you know, meeting somebody and moving away. You know, meeting someone from elsewhere. But there were a lot of sad losses here.